Today is Tuesday, January the 6th. This is Kathy coming to you with the Pantograph. Headline for today. The Capitol riot still haunts officers. Many feel betrayed by Trump's pardons by Mary Claire Jelinek. As Donald Trump was inaugurated for the second time on January 20th, 2025, former Capitol Police Sergeant Aquilino Gonnell put his phone on Do Not Disturb and left it on his nightstand to take a break from the news. That evening, after Gonnell spent long time with family and took his dog on a walk, his phone started to blow up with calls. He had messages from federal prosecutors, FBI agents, and the Federal Bureau of Prisons, all letting him know that the new president had just pardoned about 1,500 people who were convicted for their actions at the Capitol on January 6, 2021. The pardons included rioters who injured Gonnell as he and other officers tried to protect the victims. They told me that people I testified against were being released from prison, Gonnell said, and to be mindful. Gonnell was one of the officers who defended the Central West Front entrance to the Capitol that day, as Congress was certifying Democrat Joe Biden's victory, and hundreds of Trump's supporters broke into the building, echoing his false claims of a stolen election. Gonnell was dragged into the crowd by his shoulder straps as he tried to fight people off. He almost suffocated. In court, he testified about injuries to his shoulder and foot that still bother him to this day. They have tried to erase what I did with the pardons and other attempts to play down the violent attack, Gonnell said. I lost my career, my health, and I've been trying to get my life back. 5 years since the siege, Gonnell and some of the other police officers who fought off the rioters are still coming to terms with what happened, especially after Trump was decisively elected to a second term last year and granted those pardons. Their struggle has been compounded by statements from the Republican president and some GOP lawmakers in Congress minimizing the violence that the officers encountered. It's been a difficult year, said Officer Daniel Hodges, a Metropolitan Police Department officer who was also injured as he fought near Gonnell in a tunnel on the West Front. Hodges was attacked several times, crushed by the rioters between heavy doors and beaten in the head as he screamed for help. A lot of things are getting worse, Hodges said. More than 140 police officers were injured during the fighting on January 6th, which turned increasingly brutal as the hours wore on. Former Capitol Police Chief Thomas Manger took over the department 6 months after the riot. He said in a recent interview that many of his officers were angry when he first arrived, not only because of injuries they suffered, but also they resented the fact that they didn't have the equipment they needed, the training they needed to deal with the unexpectedly violent crowd. Several officers who fought the rioters told the Associated Press that the hardest thing to deal with has been the effort by many to play down the violence, despite a trove of video and photographic evidence documenting the carnage. Trump called the rioters he pardoned, including those who were most violent toward the police, patriots and hostages. He called their convictions for harming the officers and breaking into the building a grave national injustice. I think that was wrong, Adam Eveland, a former District of Columbia police officer, said of Trump's pardons. If there were to be pardons, Eveland said, Trump's administration should have reviewed every case. I've had a hard time processing that, said Eveland, who fought the rioters and helped push them off the Capitol grounds. The pardons erased what little justice there was, said former Capitol Police Officer Winston Pignon, who was part of the force's civil disturbance unit on January 6th. He left the force several months afterward. Hodges and Gonnell have been speaking out about their experiences since July 2021, when they testified before the Democratic-led House committee that investigated the January 6th. Since then, they have received support, but also backlash. At a Republican-led Senate hearing in October on political violence, Hodges testified again as a witness called by Democrats. After Hodges talked about his experience on January 6th, Senator Peter Welch, Democrat of Vermont, asked the other witnesses whether they supported Trump's pardons of the rioters, including for those who injured Hodges. Three of the witnesses, all called by Republicans, raised their hand. I don't know how you would say it wasn't violent, said Hodges, who is still a Washington police officer. It has not just been politicians or rioters who have doubted the police, it's also friends and family. My biggest struggle through the years has been the public perception of it, Evelyn said, and navigating conversations with people close to him, including some fellow police officers who do not think it was a big deal. It's hard for me to wrap my head around that, but ideology is a pretty powerful thing, he said. As police officers struggled in the aftermath, Manger, the former Capitol Police Chief, said the department had to figure out how to better support them. There were no wellness or counseling services when he arrived, he said, and they were put in place. The officers who were there and were in the fight, we needed to make sure they got the help they needed, Manger said. Manger, who retired in May, also oversaw improvements to the department's training, equipment, and operational planning and intelligence. He said the Capitol is now a great deal safer than it was when he arrived. If the exact same thing happened again, they would have never breached the building. They would have never gotten inside. They would have never disrupted the electoral count, Manger said. Pignon, the former Capitol police officer, said he believes the department is in many ways unrecognizable from what it was on January 6th and when he left several months later. It was a wake-up call, he said. The next headline, Eagle Theaters Fade to Black. Owner shuts sights in Clinton, Streeter, Robinson sights trends. Olivia Jacobs. The Clintonia Eagle Theater in Clinton, the Streeter Eagle 6th and Streeter, and the Eagle Theater in Robinson have closed their doors. The local chain of theaters was started in 2004 by Eric Grubelman. In 2024, the owner shared that the theaters were at risk of closing, and since then, he and others put in their best efforts to ensure that didn't happen. But it wasn't enough. Grubelman announced Sunday the three theaters were closed, and their website showed no additional showing scheduled. Other than that, how is the play, Mrs. Lincoln? That's one of those questions, Grubelman said Monday morning of his feelings about the closings. I've got a lot of work to do, you know, clean-up work to keep busy. Yeah, so that's distracting, but we did leave the door open a little bit in our post. Grubelman said the theaters were victims of long COVID and the economic effects of the pandemic, noting an increase in streaming, disruption of movie supply lines, the politicization of movies, and people spending more time on their couches and smartphones and less time out in their communities. The theater chain's investor had been committed to helping to keep the theaters open by acquiring the buildings and debt, Grubelman said, but the investor's participation and funding were largely dependent upon a project of his own being funded. That project has been delayed repeatedly due to outside circumstances which made him unable to keep his commitment when it came to Eagle Theaters, the owner explained. Grubelman announced the closures in Facebook posts for each of the three venues. The post for the Clintonia received more than 75,000 views in about 12 hours, Grubelman said, with similar numbers for Robinson and Streeter. Community members flooded the comment section, sharing their memories of the theaters, including first dates, engagements, and more. The posts also included a link to a survey asking community members if they would commit to seeing one movie a month at the theater. The owner said the survey received about 700 commitments overnight, but to make a difference, the theaters would have to have 4,500 commitments of around 1,500 people per location. If he had this kind of response a year ago, things may have been a bit different now, Grubelman said. The business owner said he will see what happens in the next week or two, but he has no definite plans to reopen or a timeline in which to do so. If you think of a movie theater as your in-person alternative to Netflix, it fails. But if you think of your theater as a community hub for entertainment that requires a certain level of membership and support, it succeeds. And I don't know how that gets answered. We've tried for a year to sort of explain this, he said. For each theater, it's a little different, he added. The Robinson Theater was acquired by their main lender and is subject to court confirmation around January 15th. The Clinton building will go to a sheriff's office sale later this month, and the lender will likely be the winning bid to keep control of the property, Grubelman said. The Streeter building is in Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and Grubelman said they asked the court to dismiss the bankruptcy so they can begin the liquidation process. The possibilities for the theaters include adaptive reuse, such as the bank giving them to someone to turn them into storage buildings. Some theater operator will attempt to buy the buildings, or if Eagle's current investor's project was on track tomorrow, they would have a conversation with the bank. Our customers have kept us going, even as the institutional pro-business organizations have given up. And along the way, we asked ourselves, why are we still doing this? Why is it important for us to finish out the year? And it was not some vague love of movies or communities. It was for love of our customers, he said. And we stayed open as long as we did to give us the best chance to continue serving those folks, and those are the relationships that we'll miss the most. You can contact Olivia Jacobs at 309-820-3352, or you can follow her on Twitter at Olivia_Jacobs. This headline, Bloomington rally slams attack Trump's policies, Venezuela protest, Olivia Jacobs 5 hours ago. And there is a picture here of some protesters, and it says Lisa Flanagan of Normal pictured here holding an American flag during the protest against the U.S. attack on Venezuela. Bloomington. More than 100 Bloomington Normal residents came together to protest the United States weekend attack on Venezuela that resulted in the arrest of President Nicolas Maduro. Protesters gathered bundled up and carrying signs along Veterans Parkway near Benny's Beverage Depot and Hy-Vee grocery store. They spent about an hour Sunday afternoon in an emergency day of action that followed similar protests and demonstrations across Illinois on Saturday. We all woke up yesterday morning to the news of an illegal action conducted by our military, ordered by this administration, and we knew we had to do something, said Brad Bell, an organizer with Bloomington 55501, the group behind the No Kings protest held last year. We haven't held a protest in a while. We know it's really cold, but clearly a lot of people feel very strongly about it, and we're here to express our opposition. President Donald Trump said on Saturday the U.S. government would run the country temporarily and tap Venezuela's vast oil reserves to sell large amounts to other countries. However, Secretary of State Marco Rubio told media Sunday the U.S. would not take a day-to-day role of governing Venezuela other than enforcing an existing oil quarantine on the country. Trump described the mission as an extremely successful operation that should serve as a warning to anyone who would threaten American sovereignty or endanger American lives. Jan Reynolds, 66, of Bloomington, said if the people don't protest the Trump administration's military action in Venezuela, what's to stop this administration from using force anywhere they want, including against American citizens? That's why we should care, said Reynolds, who is one of the leaders of the social justice team at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Bloomington. Lisa Flanagan of Normal attended the protest Sunday with a friend and described her feelings toward the Venezuela incident as yet another outrage the Trump administration has done that benefits Trump and all the cronies and the billionaires. Flanagan, 47, is also a member of the Unitarian Universalist Church and has attended protests in the past, she said. And I'm sick of it, and I'm angry, and it's crazy, she said. It's like, what the hell's going to happen next? It's like we're frogs in boiling water, you know? Our water's slowly reaching to a boil. With each thing, we just get more accustomed to the craziness, but this one just really drew me out here. She and her friend also agree that Congress needs to take action, and if protests are happening in Little Bloomington Normal, then there's likely more happening elsewhere. Bell, 40, of Bloomington, said the local 5501 group already has the infrastructure in place to hold protests like this at the last minute, including safety and medic teams, so organizers simply told people when and where to join the protest. He said he would have been happy with 50 to 100 attendees. Bell estimated about 120 people showed up in solidarity, and he said that he felt pretty good about the turnout considering the weather and the short notice. Several passing cars honked in support while the protesters raised their signs, which displayed their disapproval of the attack and interference in Venezuela, but also general disapproval of Trump and his administration. Chantel McClintock, 47, of Bloomington, heard of the protest from her family, who found the event on Facebook. They all attended together to protest the illegal war in Venezuela, she said. McClintock had attended the No Kings protests in the past and repurposed a sign from those protests to write, "No blood for oil, fund health care, not warfare." Instead of killing people, save people, she said. Similar protests were held Saturday in Decatur, Champaign, Edwardsville, Galesburg, Macomb, Rockford, Springfield, St. Louis, and Chicago. At the end of the day, it's an illegal action, and whether you like Maduro or not, whether you think he was illegitimate or not, it doesn't matter. We have laws, and there are international laws. This action violated both, Bell said, and it's up to us. If no one gets upset about it, then they just get away with it. And if there's no visible protest, then politicians don't know how to respond to it. So that's why we have to be vocal. And related to that article, Maduro pleads not guilty to drug counts, by Michael Sisak, Larry Neumeister, and Eric Tucker. New York, the post-Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro declared himself innocent and a decent man as he pleaded not guilty to federal drug trafficking charges in a U.S. courtroom on Monday. "I am innocent. I am not guilty. I am a decent man," the president of my country, Maduro told a judge. Maduro is making his first appearance in an American courtroom Monday on the narco-terrorism charges that the Trump administration used to justify capturing him and bringing him to New York. Maduro, wearing a blue jail uniform, and his wife were led into court around noon for a brief but required legal proceeding that will likely kick off a prolonged legal fight over whether he can be put on trial in the U.S. Both put on headsets to hear the English language proceeding as it is translated into Spanish. The couple were transported under armed guard early Monday from the Brooklyn jail where they'd been detained to a Manhattan courthouse. The trip was swift. A motorcade carrying Maduro left jail around 7:15 a.m. and made its way to a nearby athletic field while Maduro slowly made his way to a waiting helicopter. The chopper flew across New York Harbor and landed at a Manhattan heliport where Maduro, limping, was loaded into an armored vehicle. A few minutes later, the law enforcement caravan was inside a garage at the courthouse complex just around the corner from the one where Donald Trump was convicted in 2024 of falsifying business records. Across the street from the courthouse, the police separated a small but growing group of protesters from about a dozen pro-intervention demonstrators, including one man who pulled a Venezuelan flag away from those protesting the U.S. action. As a criminal defendant in the U.S. legal system, Maduro will have his same rights as any other person accused of a crime, including the right to a trial by jury of regular New Yorkers, but he'll also be nearly, but not quite, unique. Maduro's lawyers are expected to contest the legality of his arrest, arguing he is immune from prosecution as a sovereign head of state. Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega unsuccessfully tried the same defense after the U.S. captured him in a similar military invasion in 1990. But the U.S. does not recognize Maduro as Venezuela's legitimate head of state, particularly after a much-disputed 2024 re-election. Venezuela's new interim president, Delcy Rodriguez, has demanded that the U.S. return Maduro, who long denied any involvement in drug trafficking, although late Sunday she also struck a more conciliatory tone in a social media post, inviting collaboration with President Trump and respectful relations with the U.S. Before his capture, Maduro and his allies claimed U.S. hostility was motivated by lust for Venezuela's rich oil and mineral resources. The U.S. seized Maduro and his wife in a military operation Saturday, capturing them in their home on a military base. Trump said the U.S. would run Venezuela temporarily, but Secretary of State Marco Rubio said Sunday that it would not govern the country day-to-day other than enforcing an existing oil quarantine. Trump suggested Sunday that he wants to extend American power further in the Western Hemisphere. Speaking aboard Air Force One, he called Colombia's President Gustavo Petro a sick man who likes making cocaine and selling it to the United States, and he's not going to be doing it very long. He called on Venezuela's Rodriguez to provide total access to her country or else face consequences. Trump has suggested that removing Maduro would enable more oil to flow out of Venezuela, but oil prices rose a bit more than 1% in Monday morning trading to roughly $58 a barrel. There are uncertainties about how fast oil production can be ramped up in Venezuela after years of neglect and needed investments, as well as questions about governance and oversight of the sector. A 25-page indictment made public Saturday accuses Maduro and others of working with drug cartels to facilitate the shipment of thousands of tons of cocaine into the U.S. They could face life in prison if convicted. It was unclear as of Sunday whether Maduro had hired a U.S. lawyer yet. He and his wife, Celia Flores, have been under U.S. sanctions for years, making it illegal for any American to take money from them without first securing a license from the Treasury Department. While the indictment against Maduro says Venezuelan officials worked directly with the Tren de Aragua gang, a U.S. intelligence assessment published in April, drawing on input from the intelligence community's 18 agencies, found no coordination between Tren de Aragua and the Venezuelan government. Maduro, his wife, and his son, who remains free, are charged along with Venezuela's Interior and Justice Minister, a former Interior and Justice Minister, and Hector Ruthison Ford Guerrero Flores, an alleged Tren de Aragua leader who has been criminally charged in another case and remains at large. Among other things, the indictment accuses Maduro and his wife of ordering kidnappings, beatings, and murders of those who owed them drug money or undermined their drug trafficking or operation. That included a local drug boss's killing in Caracas, the indictment said. Maduro's wife is also accused of accepting hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes in 2007 to arrange a meeting between a large-scale drug trafficker and the director of Venezuela's National Anti-Drug Office, resulting in additional monthly bribes, with some of the money going to Maduro's wife, according to the indictment. On page 2, going back to the Capitol riot, the January 6th plaque, Not at the Capitol, by Lisa Mascaro. Approaching the fifth anniversary of the January 6, 2021 attack at the Capitol, the official plaque honoring the police who defended the Congress that day is nowhere to be found. It is not on display at the Capitol, as is required by law. Its whereabouts aren't publicly known, though it's believed to be in storage. House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Louisiana Republican, has yet to formally unveil the plaque. The Trump administration's Department of Justice is seeking to dismiss a police officer's lawsuit, asking that it be displayed as intended. The architect of the Capitol, which was responsible for obtaining and displaying the plaque, said it can't comment in light of the federal litigation. Some 100 members of Congress, mostly Democrats, took it upon themselves to memorialize the moment. For months, they mounted poster board-style replicas of the January 6th plaque outside their office doors, resulting in a Capitol complex awash with makeshift remembrances. On behalf of a grateful Congress, this plaque honors the extraordinary individuals who bravely protected and defended this symbol of democracy on January 6, 2021, reads the faux bronze stand-in for the real thing. Their heroism will never be forgotten. In Washington, a capital city lined with monuments to the nation's history, the plaque was intended to become a simple but permanent marker, situated near the Capitol's west front, where some of the most violent fighting took place as rioters breached the building. But in its absence, the missing plaque makes way for something else entirely, a culture of forgetting. Visitors can pass through the Capitol without any formal reminder of what happened that day, when a mob of President Donald Trump's supporters stormed the building, trying to overturn the Republicans' 2020 re-election loss to Democrat Joe Biden. With the memory left unchecked, it allows new narratives to swirl and revised histories to take hold. 5 years ago, the jarring scene watched the world over was declared an insurrection by the then GOP leader of the Senate, while the House GOP leader at the time called his saddest day in Congress, but those condemnations faded. Trump calls it a day of love. Johnson, who is among those lawmakers challenging the 2020 election results, is now the House Speaker. The question of January 6th remains. Democracy was on the guillotine. How important is that event in the overall sweep of 21st century U.S. history? Said Douglas Brinkley, a professor of history at Rice University and noted scholar. Will January 6th be seen as a seminal moment when democracy was in peril, he asked, or will it be remembered as kind of a weird one-off? And in the Veterans Corner, new Community Care Act considered. The 2018 Mission Act increases access to health care from non-VA medical providers at the VA's expense through an enhanced form of community care, which has been around since World War II era. Today, about 40% of all VA care is provided through community care. This usually results in fewer long trips and long waits for appointments at distant VA facilities. This is great for the average individual veteran. However, satisfaction with care resulting from these improvements may have a significant dark side in the longer term. Periodically, over several decades, there have been attempts to wean veterans from the VA and divert those VA budget dollars to other federal insurance plans like Medicare, Medicaid, DEERS, CHIPS, SHIPS, TRICARE, and others. Keep in mind that the VA healthcare program is the only government program that actually offers care, not just the processing of healthcare claims like an insurance company. At a 40% usage rate of non-VA providers, are we in danger of losing VA healthcare? Granted, many appointments are routine and could be handled by non-VA providers. But what about the service-connected medical issues and conditions that arise from military service? VA providers treat injuries and medical conditions rarely seen in the private medical sector. Toxic exposure like Agent Orange, Camp Lejeune, contaminated water, burn pits, JP-4 and JP-5 jet fuels, and many others are common only to those who served in the military at certain times and places. Equally important is the fact that the results of VA medical care, information about the health and medical conditions, are reported to the Veteran Benefits Administration, who use this information to help determine which medical conditions could be presumed to have been caused by military service. We should be pleased with the new choices to receive care in a timely manner, closer to home than community care can offer. However, keep your eye on the 600-pound gorilla lurking in the corner. Marine Corps new fitness standards implemented. Effective January 1, 2026, the Marine Corps rolls out significant updates to its physical fitness and body composition requirements aimed at aligning standards with the physical demands of combat roles and ensure all Marines maintain peak readiness. The physical fitness test will use sex-neutral scoring for Marines in combat, arms primary military occupational specialties. Male and female Marines in these roles will follow the same scoring standards based on male age norm guidelines from Marine Corps Order 6113A. Combat arms Marines must achieve a minimum score of 210 points out of 300, which represents 70% of the maximum. Non-combat arms Marines will continue using existing sex and age norm standards. Besides the fitness test change, the height and weight standards will be updated as well. The current height, weight, and tape test methods will change to a waist to height ratio approach. The new waist to height ratio is calculated by dividing the waist circumference by height, both in inches. A ratio below 0% typically indicates low to moderate risk, while 0 or higher may signal a higher risk. It might be interesting to use our own waist to height calculation to see how we stack up against active duty fitness standards today. You can browse the Marines Get Tougher 2026 Unified Fitness Standards for more information. Home-based primary care enhanced in rural areas. The home-based primary care program is for veterans who need team-based in-home support for ongoing diseases and illnesses that affect their health and daily activities. Veterans usually have difficulty making and keeping clinic visits because of the severity of their illnesses and are often homebound. These conditions are not necessarily required for HBPC eligibility. This program is also for veterans who are isolated or their caregiver is experiencing a burden. Home-based primary health care can be used in combination with other home and community-based services. HBPC teams now have a new, faster, and more secure way to support veterans in remote areas, even those without internet access, thanks to the recent implementation of the Oracle Health Community Care app, formerly known as MobileCare. The app allows HBPC staff to view patient records in real time at the location where the veteran lives without having to log into a laptop computer and hope that the remote area offers connectivity to the internet. The Oracle app utilizes the smartphone system and technology. This app is being utilized with the VA-wide as the Federal Health Electronic Health Record System is implemented. By equipping HBPC teams with mobile access to patient records without needing internet access, the Oracle Health Community Care app helps deliver staff care more efficiently, securely, and effectively. HBPC must be approved through the veteran's primary care doctor and is only available to veterans enrolled in VA healthcare. For more information and resources, visit the EHR Modernization website. Quote of the day, governments are necessary, I believe we can all agree. However, legislators often write laws without specificity, or you'll find out what the bill is after you pass it. These laws are then passed to unelected bureaucrats to interpret the actions necessary to implement the law. Too often the bureaucracy implements rules which, if made public, would have prevented the legislation from being passed in the first place. The following quote illustrates the likely outcome of such overreach and political bureaucratic deceit. Quote, when all government, in as little as great things, shall be drawn to Washington as the center of all power, it will render powerless the checks provided of one government on another, and will become as venal and oppressive as the government from which we separated. And that's a quote from Thomas Jefferson. That's the end of part one. We will return with part two of the Pantograph shortly.